Corruption seems to be the new normal today. What do we do in the face of such widespread evil? What actions can we and must we take? Can the tide be turned back? The bottom line, is there any hope for America and indeed the world? I believe there is, and we're going to talk about this with Catherine Austin Fitz next on the Soaring Eagle Radio Show.
Remember that your failure to be informed does not make me a wacko.
The time has come, Dolores said, to talk of other things. Of shoes and ships and sealing wax and cabbages and kings.
My mind doesn't work that way. I got this real moron thing I do. It's called thinking. And I'm not a very good American because I like to form my own opinions. I have certain rules I live by. My first rule, I don't believe anything the government tells me. And I don't take very seriously the media or the press in this country.
Toto, I have a feeling we're not in Kansas anymore.
Nine most terrifying words in the English language are, I'm from the government and I'm here to help.
This is your last chance. After this, there is no turning back. You take the blue pill. The story ends. You wake up in your bed and believe whatever you want to believe. You take the red pill. You stay in Wonderland. And I show you how deep the rabbit hole goes.
Hello, and welcome to Soaring Eagle Radio. Your host is Mike Spaulding. Get ready to be challenged and encouraged as you consider today's news and Mike's commentary from a biblical perspective. Now, let's join Mike.
Welcome, friends. Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Soaring Eagle Radio. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes and Stitcher. We'd appreciate it if you would leave a review when you do so. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, and of course, listen to every episode on our website, SoaringEagleRadio.com. My guest today is Catherine Austin Fitz. She is the president of Solari Incorporated, publisher of the Solari Report, and managing member of Solari Investment Advisory Services. Catherine served as managing director and member of the board of directors of the Wall Street investment bank Dillon Reed & Company, as assistant secretary of housing and federal housing commissioner at the United States Department of Housing and Urban Development in the first Bush administration, and was the president of Hamilton Securities Group. Catherine graduated from the University of Pennsylvania with a BA and the Wharton School with an MBA and studied Mandarin Chinese at the Chinese University of Hong Kong. She blogs for the Solari Report at solari.com. Welcome to the Soaring Eagle Radio Show, Catherine.
Thank you. It's great to be on.
Well, it's wonderful to chat with you. Finally, I came across your name reading a book. It's a rather old book now, Crossing the Rubicon, and you wrote the foreword. And when I read that book, I told my wife, I said, I have got to do some research on this lady and track her down and see if I can have a conversation with her on the show. Just the foreword itself was a fascinating piece of writing that really intrigued me. And so that's why I reached out to you originally, Catherine. And so I'd like to start our conversation by introducing our listeners to your background and history, really, with combating systematic corruption. Your time at Hamilton Securities Group proved to be a real eye-opening experience. So would you take us through that, your time at HUD, your search for answers related to the mortgage banking?
Sure. Let me just step back. My career on Wall Street, I went to Wall Street and was there for 11 years and really loved it, but I developed a practice. I was at a very unique firm, and I have an online book that tells the story of that and everything that's happened since, called Dillon Reed and the Aristocracy.
Yes.
The Stock Profits. It's up at dunwalke.com, dunwalke.com. But I developed a practice of sort of arranging financing for big projects that people couldn't you know, said couldn't be done. So I led the recapitalization in New York City subway, bus, and commuter rail systems. And, you know, I had kind of a specialty at doing big, messy, difficult things. Anyway, I went into the Bush administration to be Assistant Secretary of Housing at the beginning of what was called the HUD scandal.
Yeah.
There'd been an extraordinary amount of what I would call black budget financial fraud at the Department of Housing and Urban Development during the 80s. It was during the Iran-Contra period and during the SNL corruption. And remember, the Federal Housing Administration basically finances single-family homes, multifamily apartment buildings, hospitals, and nursing homes, and various other kind of related housing. And so... So for 18 months, I dealt with cleaning up the mess the scandal at the Federal Housing Administration, HUD. And then when I left, I became convinced that it was essential that entrepreneurs take this new technology of the internet and digital communications and use it to get government money out of our communities. I saw a real opportunity. So we started an investment bank, and I and my partner started an investment bank in Washington, and we got hired back several years later on competitive bid to be the lead financial advisor for the FHA, and that's using the knowledge we had from having been in the Bush administration. We were able to do some pretty remarkable things to start to turn the operation to a much more lawful existence, and of course ran into the buzzsaw that from a financial standpoint, the system really needed it not to be run according to the law. You know, they needed to run it outside the law.
Yeah.
And a decision was made, of course, to dramatically to have a major housing bubble, which was really engineered from the top, from the White House, from Treasury, from the Federal Reserve, and so anybody who wanted to run the money clean had to go. And so I ended up in a big food fight. I always tell people who've seen the movie Enemy of the State, I played Will Smith in real life. And it was through that process I decided that I was going to try and understand why literally, you know, you had such enormous insistence from the top to do things in our communities that were you know, whether it's bringing in drugs, whether it's bringing in guns, whether running gentrification schemes that are really what I would call, you know, in some cases, genocide.
Yeah.
You know, why had our system become financially dependent on crime? And so I used the period during the litigation to really understand the finances of communities and how it related to a lot of the financial fraud is my particular interest. And I, you know, it's very interesting. I spent a lot of time in the years from 1998 to 2006 trying to warn investors on three continents about the housing bubble and the housing fraud.
Yeah.
And it was quite remarkable because, you know, there were various responses, but nobody wanted to hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it crashed, you know, what I heard for many years was, why did no one tell us?
Right, right. Hello.
And anyway, so I decided, I finished the litigation and decided to, I had many people coming to me asking me for help with their investments, and I started an investment advisory firm. And then I was getting so many questions every week, we started the Solari Report, which has been a deeply satisfying, you know, it's a funny way to come to a business, just answering questions, and the next thing you know, you're in the media business.
Yeah.
And so now we, you know, we publish a podcast every week that's basically helping people understand what's going on. But understanding from the point of view of the real economy, I always say there's an official reality and then there's reality. And in many areas, the two really can get very separate. So that's what I'm very interested in, helping people understand the difference between the two and sort of navigate.
Yeah. So when you left HUD, you started Hamilton Securities Group.
Right. Yeah.
You were really looking for a way, and I heard you mention it just a moment ago, you were really looking for a way to help communities divest themselves of all this federal money. Why would they want to do that?
Well, because I think financial independence, I have a wonderful friend, Franklin Sanders, who's also a pastor, who says all government money comes with a sock in the jaw.
Yeah, that's right.
And essentially, if you look at what's possible with new technology, it is possible to do much more on an independent, self-sufficient basis where you're building equity. Generally, with government money, depending on how you use it, you don't have the opportunity to build as much equity, and of course it comes with all sorts of legal and complex restrictions.
Yeah.
So where you can build and grow an economy, a local economy, without government money, or certainly without federal money that comes with lots of rules and restrictions, I think it's much healthier. So I was really looking for communities so I'll give you an example. Many times, if you look at all the money coming out of HUD, if anything, that money lowers the quality of life in a community and can do harm to the real estate, particularly if you have that kind of fraud being attached to it.
Yeah.
I first got interested in HUD first got interested in these questions. I grew up in a community in West Philadelphia during the 50s, and there were four fraudulent home builder deals on the corner, catty corner from my home, and it depressed the value of the real estate for years, including the value of my parents' home.
Yeah.
So if HUD hadn't come into that community, we would have all been better off, is what I believe. So these kind of activities don't necessarily enhance a community. I've been in many communities where literally you have a HUD home on one side of the street, and on the other side of the street you have a privately developed building, and the HUD building is not as high quality and the rent is much higher. It's not necessarily better. Anyway, so we really felt there was an opportunity to help communities develop privately. And it's very interesting, after the litigation started, I had a wonderful general counsel to the congressman who was chair of the subcommittee in the House that was overseeing, sort of community development. And he took me out for lunch and he said, look, you need to understand, private equity will not be allowed to go into low-income communities. We don't want it in there. We don't want them free to build equity. We don't want them free to build family wealth. The only equity that will go in is low-income housing tax credits. And oftentimes you'll see in this model, government money is really a control mechanism.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Right.
So when the housing market bubble burst, the narrative that was created pretty much pointed to Wall Street and the banking fraud, but really we could bring a large measure of the culpability down to the local lever, can we?
Well, let me give you an example. In 1995, I was sitting as a representative of Hamilton Securities with the leadership of the Federal Housing Administration. And they were in the process of dictating low-income housing goals for Freddie and Fannie. And the story I'm now going to tell you is one of the reasons for the national takeover and the bankruptcy of Freddie and Fannie. And at the same time, the FHA was working on a strategic plan for themselves. And if you look at what they were projecting in terms of mortgage originations in low-income communities, you were going to have to originate many more mortgages than houses existed or people existed. And I looked at them, and I said, I turned to a very senior official, and I said, if you look at these numbers, this is impossible. You're talking about originating more mortgages than there are homes or people. People are going to have to refinance their homes from prison, twice a year to make these
right.
numbers work.
Right.
And the official turned to me and said, shut up, this is none of your business.
Mm.
Now, what I'm telling you is that if you – whether it was Treasury or HUD, or before you can have a housing bubble on this scale, you need for the Washington infrastructure to basically change an enormous number of terms, conditions, regulations, federal credit policies, and then the banks can let it fly.
Mm-hmm.
But it has to be, it's a very complex thing to engineer a housing bubble of that size.
Yes.
And you need the Washington and 20 different agencies and organizations, as well as the as well as the New York member banks, to do a lot of reengineering of operations and policies.
Yeah.
And so it was very much a, it was almost as though somebody blew a whistle and, you know, and they all proceeded to do exactly that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is going to be a shocking revelation to most Americans, Catherine, and particularly to Christians. I'm holding in my hand right now a special paper that you wrote, a special to the Narco News Bulletin, and this was back in 2001, but the name of it is Narco Dollars for Beginners, How the Money Works in the Illicit Drug Trade. I've heard you say before that drug trafficking and money laundering are key components in what makes the U.S. economy run. And again, I know that's a shocking statement for my listeners. And so the question I have is how, first of all, is this true? And secondly, how's this been hidden for so long if it is?
Well, when I worked in Washington, I had seen narcotics trafficking harm my neighborhood as a child.
Yeah.
But I never thought of narcotics trafficking as really important because in terms of dollars, it's so much smaller than financial fraud.
Mm-hmm.
And I always kind of poo-pooed it as being as important as it is. I think it is.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't until I came and lived, I live in a farming community in Tennessee, and I really watched how it's hit and harmed the rural communities.
Yes.
That I could see the power of narcotics trafficking.
Yeah.
Because essentially what you do is, and it's the same model, it's done all over the world, it's really a global model. You bring drugs in and you do a leverage buyout of a place. So you understand the concept of a leverage buyout of a company,
mm-hmm.
where you make a hostile bid for a company and you end up buying the company with the company's own money.
Yeah.
So you bring drugs in and you start making money in that community in a way that weakens the community and makes it easier to buy it cheap and buy it with its own money.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it actually, if you drill down and look at the financial model, particularly when you combine it with federal mortgages. So let me back up. In the old days, if the banks were underwriting the mortgages and had the mortgages on their balance sheet, the banks would fight bringing drugs in because it would lose the money.
Yes.
But once you can securitize mortgages, particularly with federal credit, you don't care.
Mm.
So the more you, the more mortgages you originate and sell into the Freddie and Fannie or other pools, the more money you make.
Yeah.
And so if you're churning and defaulting mortgages all day long, you don't care because you're making money. So by bringing in the federal credit, you create a mechanism where the incentives of the local banks change.
Yeah.
Or the financial incentives. I'm not saying the local bankers, you know, want to see their community destroyed with drugs. But you make it much more financially attractive then.
Yeah.
So let me give you a grossly oversimplified sort of view of how the model works.
Okay.
I bring in drugs. I make a couple $100,000 with the drugs. I launder it using mortgage fraud and mortgages. And so let's say in a year I generate, you know, $500,000 in that community. I can then use that $500,000 to bring in franchise restaurants.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm basically financing now bringing in those restaurants in a way that's going to put, you know, the local restaurants out of business. So I take over the market share financing with that community's money, and figure it's easier to buy up a particular lot because the guy who owns it is, his kids got in trouble and now he's got legal expenses and he needs the money.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a predatory model, and it works, you know, as a financial mechanism. It has an infinite rate of return because, again, you have no money down. You're buying the community with its own money.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Speaking of a predatory model, I'm wondering what your view is, what your thoughts are, Catherine, on the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. It seems to me that when governments come together and agree to these type of so-called free trade agreement. There's no such thing, I don't believe. But when they agree to that, especially U.S. corporations begin to invest in emerging markets, they're going to do so simultaneously placing control mechanisms to protect those investments. So what do you expect to see from the TPP, if anything, that's going to be detrimental for the U.S. job market, manufacturing base, and employment?
Well, I think it has yet to be seen how it will apply. There are two dynamics here. One is the United States is trying to rope our allies into trading partnership with the U.S. before they instead sort of swear allegiance economically to China. If you look at a lot of the companies in the mix in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the importance of China as a trading partner is growing so significant now that the U.S. is defensive and trying to rope them back into sort of alliance with us.
Yeah.
And, of course, the argument would be if we don't do that, then, you know, we're going to be at a severe disadvantage as China becomes more and more important and the Asian ring becomes more and more important to those countries as opposed to us.
Yeah.
So they would say, you know, there's a reason to be on the offense. The problem, of course, is what you're doing is you continue to rig privileges for large organizations in a way that stymies the local economy.
Mm-hmm.
And you're creating a differential in the cost of capital between the small business and the large corporation that weakens the overall economy.
Yeah.
So to try and aggregate things to compete with, you know, basically the Asian juggernaut, you're strengthening your big guys, but you're doing it in a way that really kills market competition and cuts off sort of the little guy by loading him up with a handicap vis-a-vis the large guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I think the more we do that, the more destructive it is of the health and wealth of the general economy. At the same time, I appreciate the problem of how are you going to compete head-on with Asia and do it effectively and sort of keep your geopolitical position?
Yeah.
Could I go back to the question of how could the, you know, whether it's the drugs or financial fraud, how could the systemic corruption have been going on so long and we not know?
Yeah.
Okay, so I think that's a very important and wonderful question. And it was interesting because for many years people tried to tell me how bad the narcotics trafficking was and the financial fraud and that it was top-down. In other words, it was basically being engineered from the top, not the bottom.
Yeah.
And, you know, I didn't believe them because I couldn't believe that it could go on and me not see, you know, me not know.
Right.
So it was very funny. After I entered into litigation with the federal government, one of my attorneys asked me to put together a recording of all my recollections of working in the Bush administration, which I did. And it became a big hit on the internet. It was, cause so many people wanted to listen to it that we finally put it up. And then during the litigation, I had all sorts of various people who'd done financial fraud for the intelligence agencies show up and teach me the different fraud models, and I could work that into what had, you know, the fraud I'd been cleaning up when I was the Assistant Secretary of Housing.
Mm-hmm.
And it took me years of unpacking what was going on financially, because I need math. You know, I need the mathematics of time and money to make sense of things.
Yeah.
And I was able ultimately to put together mathematically how the fraud was occurring with very few people knowing about it. And there are a couple of things which are critical to doing that. One is a lot of the money is engineered through information systems, digital systems, and is carefully laundered so that you really, as long as there's no good financial disclosure, not a lot of people need to know. Now, if there was good financial disclosure, if you and I got got financial government financial statements for our congressional district,
mm-hmm.
we would see it in a flat second. But as long as you keep place-based transparency off the table
mm-hmm.
and keep that invisible,
yeah.
You know, it's extraordinary what you can do through the systems and through the government accounts. You know, a few big banks, a few government accounts, and as long as you keep the, you know, the U.S. government has, in violation of the law, never produced audited financial statements as required by law. And what they have produced says that more than $8.5 trillion has gone missing since, you know, since 1998. So,
yeah.
Anyway, so one is it's only a few people. The other is there is an amazing control system, first of all, with what I call control files.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know what a control file is?
I do not.
Okay, control file. If you go to Soleri.com, I've written a commentary to explain it. Control file is a – remember J. Edgar Hoover and his dirty pictures?
Yes.
Okay. So everybody who rises to a certain level has a control file.
Oh, okay.
And if you don't do what you're told,
okay,
you know, the pictures in your control file will be pulled out. Now,
mm-hmm.
it was very interesting. When my Hamilton Securities was attacked in the enemy of the state thing,
mm-hmm.
They falsified evidence and tried to frame us, and I was able to prove that the evidence was false. And then they tried to falsify and frame us again. We caught that and proved that it was false, and we proved that they had falsified and they knew it.
Oh.
And so, you know, now I ended up spending $6 million in 11 years proving that it was all false. But not everybody has 11 years and $6 million
right,
to spend.
Right. Yes.
So a control file is basically a way of invisibly controlling. And then finally, if you look at the incentives and the punishments
mm-hmm.
That are used, you know, people are regularly poisoned.
Yeah.
You know, they're assassinated. People in their families are assassinated or
yeah.
threatened.
Yeah.
I mean, on and on. So we're talking about, at the highest levels, you know, extraordinary benefits for playing ball and extraordinary punishment for not playing ball.
Yes.
You know, so when I went through the litigation, the most difficult part of it was an unbelievable smear campaign
yeah.
that went on for years and very serious physical harassment that's very intimidating.
Mm.
And what was interesting is I had a wonderful church in Washington, and I had grown up in an African-American neighborhood, and in fact, the person I was closest to as a child was the, we had a woman helping our family. She was the family cook, and she literally raised me. And she was a Baptist, and she had, you know, a very powerful connection to the African-American churches. And I knew to go back into that community because I knew they had the technology. You know, if you study spiritual warfare in the really great black churches,
mm-hmm.
they've been dealing with this machinery for hundreds of years.
Yeah.
Because the important thing to understand about the people running this is essentially they're slavers.
Yeah.
And if you look at their family capital, you know, their money and their tradition goes back to the slave trade for many of them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I went to the black churches, I studied spiritual warfare, and it was really the tools of spiritual warfare that are the reason I'm alive today.
Mm.
And, the beauty of learning spiritual warfare is it really works.
Yes, that's right. Yes, it does. Yes.
Yeah, but you know, it's, what did they say about Jesus? Only drowning men can see him.
Yeah.
I would never have wanted to prove that to myself unless I had no other choice but to try.
Yes, that's right.
Right.
Amen.
Yeah. So let me just keep going. So control files are a big part of the problem. Another part of the problem is what I call entrainment technology and subliminal programming.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're in a world where the media uses extraordinarily powerful technology to help brainwash and influence.
Yes. That's right.
And I won't spend a lot of time on that today. We have a great Soleri report on entrainment technology because I became so concerned that some of my clients were being targeted. It's used to target people sometime with investments, and you know, and it's pretty scary because you and I've been in. I tell the story in the Salieri Report about being in a speech where it was being used, mm-hmm. and it's very powerful stuff.
Yeah.
So I think that contributes it. And finally, the last. Have you heard my red button story?
I have, but please share that with our listeners.
I think that's the greatest insight I had about why we've never dealt with this as a mm-hmm. society. And I was giving a speech to a wonderful a group of people called Spiritual Frontiers Foundation, and I'd been asked to give the speech on how the money works in organized crime, which later became the article you mentioned, Narco Dollars for Beginners. And I was in the middle of the speech, and I asked this wonderful group of people. We were talking about the fact that the United States Congress had testimony in 1998 on allegations of narcotics trafficking by the U.S. intelligence agencies, including the so-called Dark Alliance allegations.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, a spokesperson for the Department of Justice had told a reporter I was working with that the U.S. government or the U.S. financial system launders, I think, $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of all illegal money. So that includes narcotics trafficking, but everything illegal. And I think with financial fraud, it went much higher than that afterwards.
That's an astounding statement. That's an astounding statement.
It's a very significant part of our financial system.
Yeah.
Very significant.
Yeah.
And so I said to this wonderful group of spiritually evolved people, what would happen if we stopped being the global leader in money laundering? And they said, well, you know, we'd have trouble refinancing the government deficit, and that money would leave and go to other stock markets and not the New York Stock Exchange. So our 401ks would go down. And I said, you know, and then we'd, you know, and if we had trouble financing the government deficit, our taxes might go up and our government checks might stop. And I said, okay, well, let's pretend there's a big red button up here on the lectern. And if you push that button, you can stop all hard narcotics trafficking in your city, your town, your country tomorrow. That's offending the people who control $500 billion to $1 trillion a year of all dirty money and the accumulated capital they're on.
Mm-hmm.
I said, who here will push the button? Out of 100 people dedicated to evolving our society spiritually, only one would push the button. So I said to the other 99,
wow,
why would you not push the button? And they said, we don't want our taxes to go up, and we don't want our government checks to stop, and we don't want our 401ks to go down.
Wow.
And what I realized that day was the problem is not that we wouldn't push the red button. The problem was that we weren't willing to have a conversation, how do we turn the red button green? How do we make
yeah.
money pushing the red button? Because the reality is you don't make money by liquidating your human capital.
Right.
So whether it's, you know, marketing rotten food to people or marketing narcotics into neighborhoods or any of these things that tear people down.
Yes.
Ultimately, that's not how you build a great economy. That's how you liquidate an economy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so, in fact, there is a way to make money pushing the red button, but you got to turn it green. You got to push in a certain way. But you have to feel free to come into the room and have an honest conversation without fear. And that is what we have not been able to do. We have not been able to create a way for Christians in this country to come into a safe place and talk honestly in a way that doesn't violate their fiduciary obligation to their families, their children, their colleagues.
Yeah.
You know, if you try and deal with it, you take on more risk. And, you know, I would say the history of the last 70 years is people who tried to take it on, it's generally brought, you know, risk or trouble to them or their families. So the question is, how do we create a safe invention room where we can go face these things, talk about it? I used to have a pastor who would say, if we can face it, God can fix it. And I think, you know, I think what we're talking about first and foremost is spiritual warfare, because the problem is not drugs. The problem is we've allowed righteousness to leave our families and our communities, and we need to bring it back.
Yeah.
And the question is how.
Yes.
And I think first and foremost, you've got to cleanse spiritually and rebuild spiritually. I was just telling someone, kind of rolling on here, forgive me.
No.
I was just telling somebody, quoting Nehemiah 4:17 yesterday about having to have a rebuild the wall at the same time you're having to fight.
Yeah, that's right.
And you need a hammer in one hand and a weapon in the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're in that kind of situation because the wall has broken down to the city and all sorts of demonic spirits are coming in.
Yes.
And we're having to fight them at the same time we have to rebuild the wall.
Yeah.
And I think that's the question. How do we bring righteousness back in one person, one family, one community at a time, and do it in a way where we deal with these forces together?
Yeah. What you've described, Catherine, is really a dependence that Americans have become accustomed to that really is a violation of individual rights here in our own nation, but when you expand it out and you realize that drugs are coming across our borders, they're being swapped for weapons and other services and activities, there's a price that we're going to have to pay for living
right.
this version of the American dream. And we're not going to get away with this indefinitely. And so I think what you're saying is there is a great need for the church to understand this battle that we're in, this spiritual warfare, and really to somehow disconnect from the media matrix that we find ourselves in. And you mentioned that briefly earlier, that we are conditioned to believe certain things.
Right. Well, the first, here's the way I think of it. I think the first thing when you look at my decision making, because I'm generally not a fighter. I'm somebody who wants to find a solution and, you know, let's get into alignment, move on down the road. So the last thing I ever expected was to litigate with the federal government. But a series of things happened, and I realized, you know, what I'm dealing with here is so corrupt, I want nothing to do with it. And I'm going to fight because there is a line between freedom and slavery.
Yeah.
And I'm not a slave, and I'm not going to work in a system that pays me to commit genocide against honest people.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to do that.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what's going on here is not okay. You know, we're building a model that is predatory and making money on entrapping people and causing them to fail.
Yes.
In a way which is lawless and is using extraordinary technology to engineer it. And it's, you know, it's entrapment. It's illegal.
Yeah.
It's a criminal model. So I'm not going to go along. I'm going to fight. I'm going to try and stop it. But I'm also going to find... You know, I'm going to find another way because clearly this is not, in the end, going to work.
Right.
And so, but the reason I did that was because I believe my soul is immortal.
Mm. Yes,
and,
right.
And I think you need to understand. I just heard a great sermon that quoted a quote from C.S. Lewis, and I wish I had it. But basically what C.S. Lewis said, he said, imagine if, you know, every 80 years you do all sorts of shenanigans because you don't know your soul's immortal. And then after 1,000 years, you're living with 1,000 years of accumulated karma.
Yeah.
And he said, that is hell.
Mm-hmm.
Hell's
right.
not a place. Hell's,
yes.
you know, 1,000 years of accumulated karma when you were too materialistic to know
yes.
that
yes.
your soul is immortal. So I think, you know, part of it is we each have to make that determination, and I really think that, you know, there are things that are much worse than death, and so, you know, I think we all have to decide that, you know, are we prepared to face death if that's the price of practicing the golden rule?
Yes, yeah.
Okay, because that's kind of how evil backs us up every time.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, we try and take shortcuts, we try and do what's convenient, so I think that's number one. The second thing is, you have to believe that there is a way for the economy to work in righteousness.
Yeah.
And what's interesting is if you look at the work that I have done, both on Wall Street and at Hamilton as an investment bank, what I came to learn by – I built relational database databases that would allow me to look at the economy on a place-based basis. And if you bring financial transparency to how the money works and you let the money optimize without all this control and interference,
mm-hmm.
let me tell you, there is no reason for poverty,
yeah.
at least that I know.
Yes.
It's quite fantastic how well, you know, things could work. And so I know there's no economic reason for, you know, there is no, we can have abundance. That's not, we have the conditions of abundance now. We've made quite an environmental mess of the planet, and, you know, it might get worse. So I'm not saying that there aren't real problems. There are. But,
yeah.
You know, sort of the thing that gets me laughing all the time is I really know there's not, you know, if we're prepared to be an advanced civilization, I don't think there are problems.
Yeah.
Now, this leads me to something which is important to understand. I've come to believe that a great deal of the sort of criminality by government started in a process where government was just trying to get a hold of secret money
mm-hmm.
to deal with the phenomena they were dealing with, you know, essentially in outer space.
Yeah.
So I don't begin to understand the UFO phenomena, but I think a lot of the challenges that we faced is government trying to deal with the sort of outer space and issues of outer space and trying to get secret money to deal with that or competition globally to deal with that. And so if you look at the what I call the black budget,
yes,
we've seen since World War II enormous pressure to get secret funding, and that secret funding has now created an enormous apparatus of you know, of it's created a huge national security state, and I believe the secrecy of that national security state and the black budget has is destroying our society.
Yeah.
So I think if you want to heal these things, it is really important to bring transparency both to what's happening, the corruption, the black budget, and what's been going on in outer space around us.
So
transparency to me is the thing. You know, number one, we can all do is pray. Number two is we can bring transparency to what's going on.
Yes. Yeah, so we need to get away from this central banking warfare model that's really got us into this situation that we're in and come back to a more...
Well, you know...
Go ahead, Kathy.
Yeah, part of our opportunity is we have an election year. An election year is a time when people spend time getting together and talking about important issues.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the number one thing we can all do in election year is there's nothing more important than great local candidates.
Mm-hmm.
The economy is controlled one county at a time.
Yeah.
So who your local officials are, who your sheriff is, there is nothing more important. Forget the presidential election. To a certain extent, that's irrelevant. What's relevant is who controls the levers locally.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And getting into the local... You know, they're usually great forums to discuss locally, you know, what's important, what's coming up, and to talk about these things and how we, you know, depending, every neighborhood's different, so it's hard to generalize, but
yeah.
how you really improve the quality of life within your community and do it in a way that creates jobs and local income. And one of the things you can do, particularly if you have local officials who are sympathetic, is create a lot more transparency around the federal budget in your place. Because we're coming into a reengineering of the federal budget after the presidential election. And I think if local communities really bring the opportunities back on the table, there's a possibility to change things.
Yes. Yeah. Catherine, I wonder if you would... tell us about the Popsicle Index. I've heard you talk about that before, and it's really a good illustration for those that think, well, things aren't really that bad. In my community, things are pretty good. So I don't know what all this talk about deteriorating cities and all these type things are. You use the Popsicle Index as an illustration to alert people to the fact that things have changed dramatically in the last 50 years.
Right. So when I was a little girl, the Popsicle Index is the percent of people in a community who believe a child can leave their home, go to the nearest place to buy a popsicle, and come home alone safely. So when I was a little girl growing up in West Philadelphia, the Popsicle Index was considered to be 100%. It was unthinkable that kids weren't free to roam. There's a guy in England who calls it freedom to roam.
Yeah.
And who draws maps and shows on average over the generations, you know, how, I think he uses a 12-year-old kid, how many miles a 12-year-old kid was free to roam. And, you know, it keeps shrinking and getting shorter and shorter and smaller and smaller.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really, I was looking for an indicator of the well-being of people within a place, and the Popsicle Index was a very good sort of, I don't know, because if the kids are safe and happy, then the adults are usually safe and happy.
Yeah.
And the way I came to it was when I first became Assistant Secretary of Housing, I suddenly realized everybody was lobbying me to come up with a policy that wasn't good for communities or the taxpayers necessarily. It was just what would make their stock go up. And I realized, you know, everybody's fighting for the Dow Jones Index, but nobody's fighting to make communities well.
Yes, right.
So I thought, and of course this is all made worse by the fact that nobody's getting financial statements for their congressional district, which means, you know, you can corrupt the money in a way that hurts places but makes money for your stock,
mm-hmm.
which is exactly where we started the conversation. So
yes.
I said, okay, well, we have the Dow Jones Index, but we need an index for the community, so the Popsicle Index. And what I realized is, you know, the Dow Jones Index has been going up, up, up my entire lifetime, but in most places the Popsicle Index has been going down.
Yes.
And the beauty of the Popsicle Index is it's your Popsicle Index is whatever you believe it is. It's whatever you feel it is, because it's designed to be something that can't be controlled by academicians who are financed by big bankers. You know what I mean? I want
yeah.
something that's basically out of control and which is truly an expression. And the interesting thing about the Popsicle Index, my favorite thing to do, is to have a conversation with people. You know, you go into a neighborhood and say, well, what's your Popsicle Index? And what are the things that make it go up and down? And then you have a communication, and it's very interesting.
That's right, yeah.
You know, I've been in places where a mother said, well, the Popsicle Index here is 100%. Her son looks at her and says, no, it's not, Mom, it's zero. And they kind of look in shock at each other, and then they start talking, and
mm-hmm.
what you discover are ways to improve.
Yes.
You know, the child's Popsicle Index, you know, and
yes.
the whole goal is to what do we have to do to get to 100% Popsicle Index. And my interest as an investment banker has always been, how do you create a world where the Dow Jones and Popsicle Index have a win-win, lose-lose relationship?
Yes.
So
yeah.
you re-engineer the financial system so a rising Popsicle Index means a rising Dow Jones Index.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the old expression, what's good for America is good for General Motors.
Yeah. yeah.
What's good for General Motors is good for America. You know, we've lost that.
And yes.
So the question is, how do we get back to, you know, where we're in alignment and we're pulling together
yes.
to try and get both to go up instead
yes.
of having a win-lose relationship between the two.
Yeah. And I think it starts, Catherine, with what you mentioned earlier, and that's why I asked the question. Getting back to righteousness as individuals, but also as communities. When the community standard for morality and values and what's important, when people matter and they become the primary concern in a community, I think we're going to see a drastic beneficial increase in the Popsicle Index.
Well, I agree with that, except most of the people in communities are subject to tremendous pressure coming top down
mm-hmm.
to play ball.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that pressure ultimately comes back to the ability to kill with impunity.
Yes.
So let's say I'm a group of people on a city council, and I'm hardworking, sincere, I want the Popsicle Index to go up. You know, I have somebody who wants a contract, let's say they want the waste contract in my city.
Mm-hmm.
And they're using a private security firm to listen to our telephone conversations,
yeah.
to bug our meetings, and then to strong-arm us when we don't vote the way they want.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, or, you know, they threaten lawsuits.
Mm-hmm.
So when you're up against people who use covert operations to get their way, you know, life becomes very tricky.
Yeah.
So I think part of rebuilding righteousness is, you know, we have to learn to be, you know, what's the expression? Gentle as a lamb, but wise as a fox. What's the scripture?
Oh, yeah. Gentle as a lamb, wise as a serpent.
Right.
Yeah.
So what we're figuring out is how can righteous people get together and create a capacity to safely be wise as serpents.
Yes. Yeah.
Because there's no doubt if you look at the tactics that are being used to control top down, they are dirtball.
Yeah. Yeah. Well.
So.
And we've seen that with the mysterious deaths of the holistic doctors. That's one example.
Right.
And clearly. There was some nefarious activities going on there. That those deaths were not an accident at all.
Right.
But so getting more local control, I guess. Going back to your illustration of Nehemiah rebuilding the wall while simultaneously holding a spear in one hand or a sword in one hand, defending what you're doing at the local level to rebuild the local economy against all of this top-down control. What can we do?
So
what can we tell people?
I think the first thing we need to do, I've spent years watching and trying to study examples of community prayer.
Mm-hmm.
I think the first thing you need to do is to come together in prayer.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know if you studied any of the groups that do community prayer, the examples, you know, but I think, you know, the one of the keys to the process of turning things around is coming together in prayer, using prayer to access discernment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what should we do?
Yeah.
And providing prayer covering.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's all part of sort of cleansing the field before we try and do anything in the real world.
Yeah.
And then I think as we do that, we have to work out from rebuilding both our income and assets. We have to go at this in a very practical way. And there was a wonderful church in Virginia, I think it was in Norfolk, that literally went around the congregation and helped everybody to get out of debt.
Wow.
And they would take special offerings and just, mm-hmm. you know, counsel a family, and then they'd pull a special offering and get them out of debt. So,
wow.
You know, that's one example. But
mm-hmm.
I think we have to start with ourselves and say, okay, how do we make sure we're on solid ground? How do we help other people do the same? What are the businesses we can build here? How do we proceed to help each other? And every place is so unique and different,
mm-hmm.
and every congregation so different. I think you've got to start where you are, and that's
yeah.
going to be a very different place in each place.
Yeah. Should the church, Catherine, be encouraging people to get involved in the local political offices?
If they're moved to do it. You know, everybody's got a different person in life. What I would say is, here's what I've seen. In most every area, you have excellent people who are interested and good at local political office.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's very important to say to those people, what can we do to help you? What can we do to support you?
Yeah.
The challenge we've had in local politics is the really excellent people are being drained.
Yeah.
So they're being taken advantage of. They're finding it hard to, you know, do what they do. If we can make life much more energizing for them and just support them,
mm-hmm.
you know, we're going to get a benefit, and we go from there. So what I would do as a church is identify both the people locally who are running for office that you think are really, you know, really have an anointing to
mm-hmm.
and are good at what they do.
Yeah.
And then find the people who are in the congregation who are interested in running or serving or whatever, and you support them.
Yeah. Yeah. I recently looked at your Solari report, the 2015 annual wrap-up, and it gives some very good advice for people to take action. Now, I'm wondering if you would give us a rundown, give our listeners a little taste of what you talked about, and hopefully they'll go there and subscribe.
Okay, well, one of the things I talked about, I think an area very near and dear to my heart is education. And one of the things that most concerns me now is what's happening in the school system.
Mm-hmm.
And I think whether it's forced vaccination or common core and testing, the school system has reached a very unfortunate place.
Yes.
And so anything that a community can do or a church can do to help provide alternative education, you know, that helps the children there be excellent and make sure they're healthy and safe,
yeah,
is exceptionally important.
Yes.
You know, because if we can't do right by our kids, you know, what can we do?
Yeah.
That's number one. Number two, I think the healthcare system, and I describe a lot more at the Solari report and in the wrap-up, but the healthcare system is very challenged in many ways. So we have to take as much responsibility for our health as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And become very knowledgeable about both nutrition and what we can do to stay healthy and encourage ourselves to do that.
Yes.
And I think there's a lot we can do through the church to just help each other become more intelligent and knowledgeable and vet, you know, people in the healthcare system who are excellent. Anyway, so I think we have to be much more knowledgeable and independent about accessing education and healthcare.
I don't know,
the
Catherine.
The third thing is, yeah?
I don't know if I read this in your wrap-up report or I just heard you say it in another interview, but to illustrate our responsibility for our own health, you mentioned that, and I don't know if it was 2014, you follow the data on grocery sales in America, and you stated that I think it was in 2014, there was about $2 billion spent on fresh vegetables and fruits in America.
It was for the year ending June 30, 2015.
Wow.
The American people in grocery stores spent $2.2 billion on fresh fruits and vegetables and over $10 billion on carbonated drinks.
Yeah. I think that's indicative of an issue.
Right. If you look at the statistics on spending on food as well as time spent on media, we're basically killing ourselves.
Yes. Yeah.
And we're spending a lot of money to do it.
Yeah. And we can rail all day long about forced vaccines and chemtrails, but if we're not taking in good, healthy food in our bodies, then we're killing ourselves.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, it comes down to doing what you can with that which you control.
Yes.
And given the level of environmental pollution, whether it's chemtrails or other things, I think the importance of good nutrition I cannot overestimate.
Yeah.
You know, another thing a church can do if it's led is there's a lot we can do to go buy, you know, I mean, you can organize groups that go down to the local terminal market, get organic food at wholesale. There's a lot you can do with buyers clubs and other things to make it possible to get fresh food. You can do deals with local farmers, CSAs, to educate yourself and arrange on a more economic basis for fresh food supplies.
Yes.
And I think that's very important because, you know, arranging to make sure you have great water and great, you know, highly nutritious fresh food over the next 10 to 20 years.
Yeah.
Is going to be very, very important.
Yeah, very, very good point. I apologize for interrupting you. You were going through three.
Oh,
I think
no,
you're on
no,
point
no.
number three.
I'm glad you brought it up. The another thing you can do, I really believe it's very important. You know, a lot of people laugh at the preppers. I don't. I think it's very important. You know, we've seen so many different areas of the world where you have, you know, you have Hurricane Katrina, you have the Kentucky power outage.
Mm-hmm.
You have a period of time, whether it's one day or 3 weeks, when you have to be, you know, survive without the infrastructure.
Yes.
So I think it's very important to have a disaster recovery plan and to be prepared to deal with disasters because the infrastructure is clearly under pressure.
Good point.
In a variety of different ways, and there are risks.
Yes.
And then another thing I talk about is the fact, you know, many people say, okay, well, it's real simple. What I need to do is I need to just leave the country and go somewhere. There's some magical, wonderful place elsewhere.
Yeah.
And I do think that there are some wonderful places that have much lower costs and better health care available, but you're going to be a stranger there. And
that's
you
right.
have to be very, very careful about assuming that that everything is fine away, because a lot of the problems that we're dealing with are global in nature.
That's right.
Or, you know, Americans are increasingly not as looked upon with as much favor as they used to be.
That's correct.
So I think you have to be very careful to make sure you're going to be happy if you decide to try and get away. So
yes.
I always tell people there is no away.
Yeah.
Another thing I really stress all the time is to be incredibly discerning about how much time you give to media. And there are two kinds of media that are dangerous, I think, to people. I think, corporate media and what I call increasingly the shriekometer is full of sort of manufactured news and reality TV show, which I think is very bad for your mind and your health. And I do think the entrainment technology and subliminal programming is off the charts.
Yes. Yeah.
So,
now I know what you
article.
I know what you mean by shriekometer, but tell our listeners what you mean by that.
Shriekometer is, last year it was the Ebola shriekometer.
Yeah.
And, Ebola and you're all going to die. And, yeah. It's all, Bill Cosby used to have a routine called the chicken heart that ate up New York City.
Yeah. Yes.
Heart is coming down the New Jersey Turnpike. Oh, the chicken heart is in your neighborhood. Oh, it's at your door. Knock, knock.
Yeah.
And this year it was the ISIS boogeyman. But the shriekometer just gets louder and louder and more rational and more rational. And it takes up an enormous amount of time and has nothing to do with any investment. You're much better off turning it off and learning how to do your own plumbing or, turn it off and use that time to do something which, builds up your intellectual or human capital or that of the people you love. So, I just think there's it's not a lot of the corporate news is not informative. And then now on the internet, the alternative news, you have a lot of what I call either fear porn or adult fairy tales.
Mm-hmm.
It's disinformation.
Yeah.
It's, it makes money by scaring you. For some people, it can even become an addiction. So it's extremely important that you use your time to build up your capital. I know in our Christmas card, let me see if I can find it. I love Proverbs 4:23. Above all else, guard your heart, for from it flows the wellsprings of life.
Yes.
Let me just read you. Can I read you what I wrote?
Yes, absolutely.
Card?
Yes.
Globally, the leading cause of death is heart disease. Approximately 7.5 million deaths a year. Let's call heart disease what it really is: a broken heart. If you break that down in the United States, 611,000 men and women die annually from a broken heart. 16,000 from homicide and 41,000 from suicide. That is to say, 1,674 people a day die from a broken heart, 112 from suicide, no doubt caused by a broken heart, and 43 from homicide, some of which or all of which are caused by a broken heart.
Yeah.
This means we should be spending at least 40 times as much concern on protecting ourselves and our loved ones from a broken heart as from a violent crime or act.
Mm-hmm.
While I appreciate that it is hard to ignore the latest boogeyman, understand that one of the goals of the people organizing and financing these operations and the subsequent boogeyman media, shriekometers, is to break your heart.
Mm.
Consequently, the best thing you can do for your health and your finances today is to nurture your faith, your hope, and your love. Feed and strengthen your heart and the hearts of those around you. So
perfect.
If you're watching the ISIS boogeyman,
mm-hmm.
it's breaking your heart, and you're not taking that time and using that time to nurture the heart of someone you love.
Mm. Very good. Very good point.
So that's my big speech. The danger in your household is not from terrorism, the danger in your household is a broken heart.
Yes. Amen. Well, that's some very practical advice. I appreciate that, Catherine. One other item that I'm hoping you'll speak on just a little bit for our listeners. In your annual wrap-up, you had an article or a section of an article that talked about do a backcasting. Would you explain that?
Sure. Backcasting is it's a form of planning, mm-hmm. where instead of forecasting, you backcast. You go into the future. You create in your imagination the kind of future you'd like to be part of.
Mm-hmm.
And then you break down the steps that will take you from here into that future.
Yes.
But you are required for the planning to assume that it's really going to happen.
Yeah.
And what's remarkable is it really helps you by visualizing and experiencing emotionally the kind of world you would most desire to live in. You are attracted into it, and it can be a very powerful technique. And if you get back to this notion of community prayer, if a community can have a vision of what it can be together in a 100% popsicle index world, and I would note, not to be the greedy investment banker that I am, but when the popsicle index goes up, the value of the real estate goes up, which I think is a very good incentive.
Yes, that's right.
Because, if you get the home builders, the mortgage bankers, and the realtors on board, you have a much better chance.
That's right, yes.
So if you can envision that 100% popsicle index world and then the steps that you as a church or a congregation or a community take to get there, then the power of that, how wonderful that is it really pulls you into it.
Yes. Yeah. That's wonderful. Folks, you can subscribe to the Soleri Report at www.soleri.com. That's SOLARI.com. Is there any other way that people can connect with you, Catherine, Twitter or anything like that?
Well, we if you come to Soleri.com, we post a tremendous amount just up for free on the website. Mm-hmm. And then I do a lot of interviews every month, and we post them as well. So there's
yes.
an awful lot of content. If you want to learn more and get to know us, there's a tremendous amount you can get, just on an open basis. You don't have to subscribe.
Yeah, and folks, if you really want to get a good grasp of everything that we've talked about, I encourage you, and I think there's a link on your website, Catherine, to the book.
I will say the thing that we most try and do for our subscribers is we do 4 wrap-ups a year, 3 quarterlies and an annual wrap-up.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically designed so that if you're too busy to pay attention to any media or news, you can read that 4 wrap-ups and you will be as well-informed as the best-informed people in the country.
Yes. Yeah.
So our goal is to make sure you have the real deal and you have it quickly and in a way that is beautiful with the graphics and, the whole nine yards. So
yes.
So it's a pretty sophisticated, it's kind of briefings that I used to get when I was at the top of Wall Street.
Yeah,
so our goal is to make sure that those wrap-ups give you an enormous amount of content with very little of your time.
Yes, excellent. Again, the website is www.soleri.com, and there you can subscribe to the report and all kinds of good informative information. Catherine, I appreciate you joining me on Soaring Eagle Radio, and I'd like to do it again real soon.
Oh, I'd love to. There's nothing more fearless than a pastor who's willing to deal with the real deal.
Amen, sister. God bless you, Catherine. Appreciate it very much.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Soaring Eagle Radio is a production of Transforming Word Ministries and is released under Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives 4.0 International License. You may subscribe to the show on iTunes, follow us on Facebook where you can discuss this episode, and of course follow Soaring Eagle Radio on Twitter at Soaring Eagle Rad, and listen to every episode from our website, www.soaringeagleradio.com. The opening audio montage collection was created by Micah 68 Productions. You can visit them on the internet at www.mika68.com for more information. Friends, remember the Apostle Paul's admonition to the believers meeting in Rome. Therefore, I urge you, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present your bodies a living and holy sacrifice, acceptable to God, which is your spiritual service of worship. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, so that you may prove what the will of God is, that which is good and acceptable and perfect. I'm your host, Mike Spaulding. Thank you for joining us today for this edition of Soaring Eagle Radio.
Thanks for tuning in today to the Soaring Eagle Radio program. For more information about the show, write us at Soaring Eagle Radio, 682 West Grand Avenue, Lima, Ohio, 45801. You may also contact Mike directly by email at the following address, Pastor Mike at WOH.